Hello, Catherine here. If you're listening to my podcast because you're a fan of wintering, the good news is that my new book, Enchantment, is available now. It's a book about how we can find a way to reconnect with a world that's sometimes hard to live in and even to find magic there. It's available in all good bookshops and please support your local indie if you can. For more information, you can go to catherine-may.com/enchantment. Happy reading.
In the market for investment-worthy bags, watches, and fine jewelry, Rebag is the answer. Rebag is a luxury resale platform where each piece is carefully inspected by experts to ensure quality and authenticity. Use Rebag to buy and sell finds from the world's top brands, including Louis Vuitton, Chanel, and Cartier. Head to Rebag.com to get 10% off your first purchase with code REBAG10. Shop today at Rebag.com. That's REBAG.com. And use promo code REBAG10 for 10% off your first purchase.
Normally, being a little extra might be a bit much, but not when it comes to healthcare. That's why UnitedHealthcare's Health Protector Guard fixed indemnity insurance plans, underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, supplement your primary plan so you manage out-of-pocket costs. Learn more at uh1.com.
Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello, I'm Catherine May and welcome to The Wintering Sessions, the podcast that sets out to learn from the times when life is frozen. This week, I'm talking to Georgina Lawton, the writer whose memoir, Raceless, deals with the lasting impact of family secrets. For most of her life, Georgina Lawton was aware that she didn't look like her white family, but by her teens, she was no longer able to believe her parents' line that she was, to quote, a genetic throwback to a black ancestor. In her memoir, Raceless, she writes about the difficult process of forging a black identity from scratch, and the painstaking work of repairing her relationship with her mother after years of denial. Georgina Lawton, welcome. It is absolutely lovely to have you on the podcast. And I have been dreaming of inviting you on here for ages.
Have you?
Because in my other job as a literary scout, I got to read the proposal for your book, like 2 years ago, maybe.
Oh my God. Okay. Interesting.
Yeah. And flagged it to all our publishers then because I thought it was just such an incredible story.
Oh, amazing.
And then was really pleased to see your book when it delivered because it was just so wonderful. And that doesn't always follow necessarily. And so I was then like, right, if I ever do a podcast, I'm definitely having her on. So I've been hounding you and I'm sorry.
No, it's fine. I'm glad we've got the time to book it in because, yeah, everybody's at home now. So it's sort of perfect timing for podcasts and interviews, isn't it?
It really is. It's made all the difference. And it does mean that you can just be a bit more bold about, you know, emailing people and going, do you fancy it?
Yeah, I've made loads of internet friends, you know, like I never thought I'd make so many sort of online friends. And I was always really wary of sort of like chatting to people on Twitter or like making those connections sort of translate to an interview or something. But now it feels so much easier and so much more sort of expected because everyone's online just doing not as much as they were before. So
no, and people are actually generally, I know we like all remember the people that are dreadful to us online, but 99.9 recurring percent of people are just absolutely lovely and just want to be nice to you.
Yeah, true. Especially other people in the industry, you know, that you sort of look at and you see their work and you follow their work. And I was like, why did I not, you know, congratulate that person before or reach out earlier? Yeah. It was just sort of intimidation. But now everyone seems to be more accessible in a good way, but also, I guess,
it's like the early days of Twitter again. It really is. Everyone's accessible again. And I think there was a period when everyone kind of zipped up their cardigan, metaphorically speaking, and everyone's unzipped a bit again. It's quite nice.
No, it's interesting. It's sort of democratized online space a bit more, hasn't it, this pandemic?
Yeah, and that needed to happen. Mm. But yeah, interesting year. So I would love to share with my listeners your amazing and really heart-wrenching story, actually.
I mean, please correct me if I phrase this wrong, but you grew up in Surrey, two white parents, but you were born black.
Yes, yeah.
And like, when did you start to notice that?
Gosh, I would say my like moment of racial reckoning, I guess, was at about 5 years old when I was at school, and I remember talking to another child and saying, why is my skin this colour? And I must have said something like, you know, I want to be your colour. I remember the girl was white and we were scratching each other's skin and she scratched mine. And when you sort of scratch brown skin, it turns this kind of temporary, like ashy colour. And I wrote about this in the book, and I remember that scene distinctly. So I must have been, yeah, 4 or 5 when I realised that I didn't look anybody else, but also that I wanted to look like, you know, my classmates and my friends and my family, I guess.
Yeah, and it was not acknowledged in your family that, I mean, did I suppose they acknowledged that you looked different, but they had a story for that, right?
Yeah, so I would go home as a child and ask my parents repeatedly, you know, sort of, I guess, with increasing frequency as I got older and became more cynical. But, you know, as a 5-year-old, maybe that was the only time I asked that year. I can't remember. And then as I got older and more people would ask questions on holiday and stuff, I would start to think, actually, no, this doesn't make sense. But as a child, you know, I'd ask every so often and then it would get forgotten about because we had an otherwise, you know, very happy, sort of normal, benign, middle class Surrey kind of upbringing with my brother. So it wasn't always at the forefront of my mind. And my mum would also say, you know, we don't need to talk about that. Or you could have inherited your looks from an Irish throwback ancestor because she comes from the west coast of Ireland. And there's this sort of spurious part of Irish history where people say, oh, you know, the west coast of Ireland was, the gene pool was made darker because the ships from the Spanish Armada were wrecked off a place called Spanish Point, which is actually near where my mum comes from in County Clare. And, you know, there are lots of people with dark hair and pale skin, but I don't look like that. I'm black, I'm visibly black. But that was the sort of story that anchored me into my mum's heritage and sort of excused or overlooked my blackness in a way. And that was something we leaned on, but it's not actually historically accurate. There wasn't enough people of sort of Moorish image to sort of infiltrate the Irish gene pool. It's not true.
And I like, for me, this is the heart of why your story is so incredible, because what it points to immediately is our inability to talk about race and blackness and our, you know, our lack of kind of comfort in the UK with being able to name that. You know, it was seen as polite to not mention it, and politeness was really painful for you, that avoidance.
Yeah, completely. I think it's really is, you know, it's my family first and foremost, but I do think our family unit is sort of a microcosm for some parts of the UK and how we just have to overlook race as a means of accepting it. And of course that shouldn't be the case. But people sort of misbelieve that if we do talk about race, then racism will follow. So we shouldn't mention it at all. And it's just better to be polite and to just say nothing. But that silence and that politeness can really stifle relationships and stifle, I guess, the sense of self from the child or the person whose race is being overlooked.
Yeah, because while you were being brought up as a white child, essentially, there were loads of parts of your experience that were that of a black child. People from the outside saw you as black and talked to you about being black.
Yeah, of course. And I guess these moments of these reminders that I was black would happen with increasing frequency, as I said, as I got older and as I got sort of more interested in exploring other parts of London, other parts of the UK, and stepping outside my comfort zone and stepping outside this sort of protective bubble of whiteness, which, you know, I loved. It was my family. Like, my dad and I were super close, and I wasn't, you know, unhappy in the situation that I was born into. I just always had questions. And yeah, other people would point out as we went into South London, oh, you look mixed race, or you look like my friend, or you look like, you know, Ethiopian, or what's your mix? And I'd have all these questions, and I'd go home and they just weren't getting answered. It was just this consistent sort of stonewalling when it came to the issue of race. So
yeah,
it was frustrating at times and lonely at times as well, because I had so much love in my life from my parents, but then I also had this sort of denial of an essential part of me, I guess.
Yeah. And there was a moment in the book where your teacher came with the class register and asked you how you could possibly say you were white British.
Gosh, yeah, I've quizzed my mum about this. And, you know, that when I went to secondary school, they marked me down on the school system. They put my ethnicity or whatever terminology we call it for these school system sort of records. They'd marked me down as white. My parents had put me down as white. So then, you know, sort of it stands to reason that eventually maybe somebody was going to say, how come you are down on the system as white? It doesn't make sense. So that my teacher's methods were trash because she called me out in front of the whole class and it was like,
yeah, that's,
you know,
awful,
embarrassing. But then she kind of did me a favor in a way because she sped me up on that process of self-acceptance. And that, you know, she reminded me I'm mixed race or I look black or, you know, however people perceive me to be, I'm still not going to be accepted into that exclusive category of whiteness, which is based around myths of purity. And, you know, it's not going to accept me, so why try?
I mean, like, I'm very definitely white, but my mum's side of the family, everyone has kind of very black hair, and I've inherited the sort of very dark eyes. And so obviously at some point in our ancestry, you know, we have, you know, somewhere like got something from like the far reaches of Europe or Asia or, you know, whatever, but nobody knows. But I mean, we attract comments on, like, weird sideways comments on it, you know, like touch of the tar brush when I was a child, I remember hearing, because my eyes were so dark. And like, it's like, on one hand, we're too polite to talk about it, and on the other hand, it kind of bursts out of people in weird offensive ways. You know, they want you to know that you look different to them, and like, my difference is so tiny that you wouldn't think it was worth commenting on, but apparently people can't resist it.
Yeah, it's interesting. Yeah, I never had, you know, derogatory comments from the people that love me, that were in my life, in my immediate circle, my family, my friends, but sort of, you know, even a few distant relatives over the years, there'd be little, not even comments about my appearance, but comments about the appearance of other people that looked like me, or thinly veiled racist remarks about, you know, crime-ridden neighbourhoods. And as a child, I'd look down at my skin and then look at the people on TV and think, well, where do I fit in? Because I look like them, but nobody's acknowledging that in these spaces where, you know, I'm supposed to be loved and I'm supposed to be seen. So it was really isolating at times, because I could hear these remarks about people that, you know, strangers would make to me, and I'd say, well, this is what I look like, and they say, oh no, you're not really black, or oh, you're one of us, or oh no, your parents are white, or whatever. And it's like the lie and the silence kind of went full circle, because we've been saying it for so long that then when other people made racist remarks and I'd pull them up on it, you know, our story would come back and hit me in the face, because they say, oh, well, you know, you don't count because your parents are white, or you've already said that you're not. And I'd be like, oh, maybe I'm not then, because people are making racist remarks in front of me, so maybe I'm not really.
Yeah.
So it was really confusing as a child at times to be in those spaces of sort of the in-betweenness.
And as a, you know, as a child and a teenager, those questions of identity are so, like, painful in you. They're so everything. They take you over, and feeling like an outsider is not something you can cope with very well when you're a child, I don't think.
Yeah, no, definitely. Every person has gone through those rituals of isolation as a teenager, whether it's like after a breakup or sort of weight problems or skin or whatever it is, like, everybody can relate to that feeling of being on the outside at some point, I think.
Yeah.
But with me, it was all of those things, but they were sort of exacerbated because I was also black, and I was the only person that was black that looked like me. So of course, if I'd grown up in a black community, I would have had a perceived amount of privilege because I'm mixed race and because my features speak to that.
Right.
But because I was the only person that looked like me, you know, in my entire year at school, I remember, in infant school, and, you know, in my church, in my family on both sides. So I was the only person.
Yeah.
So I was the blackest person there. So it wasn't sort of a privilege that I would say even existed really for me until I started to, you know, venture out past my community.
Yeah.
So yeah, it was definitely isolating at times.
Yeah. And you had an encounter with a hairdresser who said she couldn't cut your hair because it was Afro hair.
Yeah. You know, that's what I mean when we think about, you know, this sort of hierarchy of black hair, and hair like mine is often sort of awarded this sort of status of desirability because it's curly, it's not quite Afro. In the white spaces that I lived in, my hair was the most Afro hair they'd ever seen. So of course they couldn't they couldn't deal with it. So we got turned away. And I remember we just went to Croydon nearby. And, you know, we didn't discuss, me and my mum, what that meant or why we were getting the bus to Croydon or why the white hair salon in Sutton had turned. We just didn't talk about it. It was just, okay, right, we'll go find somebody. That, and we went and we found a black, you know, my mum found black hairstylists for me. But we never really spoke about why she was having to do that. Like, I don't remember having conversations about it, which, looking back, is so bizarre. But as a child, you just start to accept your normal because you want to belong.
Yeah.
So
when did that begin to change? Because I eventually, you took a DNA test, but only when your dad was very poorly, actually.
Yeah, so all those questions I'd managed to kind of keep buried within me. But even I looked at my actual old Facebook messages with friends the other day, and, you know, at 18, I was talking to them on Facebook chat about getting a DNA test. So it had been in my head, I think, from around 15, 16, because I'd sort of had enough of all the questions. And, you know, we were meeting new people, we were meeting boys on nights out, and I'd always get asked about my racial mix, and I'd never have the answer. So I kind of got it in my head that I wanted to do it. And then, yeah, when I was at uni, my dad got sick with cancer, and it was just sort of like my world or my childhood ended. And it was a really painful time, and it was really difficult to think about processing a DNA test result because he was so sick and he was so concerned with looking after me and my mum and my brother and making sure we were going to be fine without him. He was just very practical and very stoic when it came to his illness.
Sorting it out.
It was really, really hard. So I spoke to him about it, and I ordered the DNA test, and I spoke to him about it when he was ill. And I remember him being in the living room and saying, yeah, you can get the test done if you want, but I know that you're mine.
Yeah.
And
I mean, your dad just sounds lovely, you know?
Yeah, really.
And sounds like, you know, he wanted you to be his daughter because he loved you. And it must have been really hard to assert that identity that meant that you were slightly more separate to him than anyone wanted you to be.
Yeah, it was that. It came from, you know, I've talked about having, you know, your race overlooked as a means to accept it. But I do think it largely came from a place of love and him not wanting to accept that we were different biologically, because then that would mean he'd have to accept that my mum had been unfaithful, which she was, and he'd have to sort of learn to forgive her and learn to accept our difference. And he wasn't able to do that. So I do think it came from a place of love and wanting to keep the family together, and silence around my heritage and my real parentage was the only way that my parents could keep the family together, by the sounds of it. You know, I've spoken to my mum at length, but it was really difficult for me to accept that because, yeah, I never got a chance to speak about it with my dad because he passed away before I processed the DNA test results. And then I didn't get them processed until a year afterwards. They were just sitting on my shelf for ages.
Right.
And then I decided, and then, they're done. Yeah, get over with.
Yeah. And still your mum tried to deny that anything could be different for you, even at that point.
Yeah, we had the results, and she just didn't want to acknowledge that they were correct. She didn't want to go back to a part of her past that she'd kept locked up for, you know, 23 years.
Yeah.
Which I understand, but it was just really hard for me because I was in bits. I had these results and I still wasn't able to kind of get the full story from her straight away. So I had to get my brother to intervene, and we had to sit down with her. And then finally she spoke about, you know, having had a one night stand with a guy in the pub in West London. And we lived around there when I was a child for a couple of years.
Yeah. And it was just a thing that happened, and such huge consequences.
We'll be back with more from Georgina in a moment. But first, I want to tell you about my online course, Wintering for Writers, which is back online after a successful first run last summer. Wintering for Writers is designed to be a beautiful, reflective process for writers who are currently struggling, as so many are in this pandemic year. If you're feeling blocked or are losing hope, it's packed with videos and thought-provoking texts to help you rethink your practice, and there's an exclusive workbook to support your reflection. Best of all, you can work at your own pace and in complete privacy as you write yourself back into your creative flow. To find out more, go to katherinemay.com and click on courses, or follow the link in the show notes. And now back to Georgina Lawton.
I mean, what I'd love to talk about is how you began to address this feeling of like dislocation and anomie. You travelled, first of all, I think, and that helped.
Yeah, big time. I was really fortunate to be able to do that, to have the money to do that. And I was sort of working remotely from my laptop, doing writing for different sort of women's magazines. And I just knew that I had to get out of the community that I'd grown up in. It had given me so much stability. But of course, after my dad passed away, I'd lost that. Then I sort of lost our narrative to one another in a way. So I was sort of grieving twice, or grieving, you know, doubly. And things weren't good with my mum because we still weren't having honest discussions about everything. And I just thought, right, I'm going to go. I want to go. And I also want to sort of play catch up with a lot of the stuff I've missed out on as a young black woman. I've missed out on, well, it was more an like a psychological thing. I felt I'd missed out on a lot of opportunities, and I felt like I'd been sort of living half a life. So I wanted to go and live amongst black communities and just see myself reflected on a daily basis in the places that I lived.
And so where did you live? You lived all over the world, didn't you? It sounds incredible.
Yeah, I went on a good jaunt for like a year and a bit. So I went to Brooklyn, first of all, and I thought, right, I'm going to get like a journalist visa and live this sort of like, you know, girl's life, but with a black character at the forefront. Like, I was really hell-bent on on doing that. And I stayed for 6 months, but I couldn't get the right visa. So I thought, okay, right, now I'm going to go and do some travel writing. So I got offered a press trip to Vietnam. So I got flown to Vietnam, and then after that I was like, okay, I'm going to keep traveling. So I went to Nicaragua, Dominican Republic, Cuba, and then I came back to London and I got another press trip for South Africa and Zimbabwe.
Wow. And being a black person in a black majority country is a very different experience, I assume, to being black in a white majority country.
Yeah, there were so many questions that got brought up in my mind as a black female traveller with a British passport. So I could see myself reflected in places like the Dominican Republic. I blended in so well there. Everybody thought I was Dominican, and also in Cuba. And that was a great privilege in a way, to blend in like a local, to pass as a local. But then with that also comes discrimination, because you see how people with darker skin are treated in places like Cuba. You know, it seems like there's such an egalitarian society, but as I put in the book, if you do a little bit of digging, it's white Cubans that all have bank accounts, because not everyone has bank accounts. It's white Cubans that own most of the property. And there's a lot of racism in these black majority countries, these beautiful places within the diaspora that are so vibrant and so enchanting. And to move through that as a black woman was fascinating. And I feel really lucky that, you know, in a way, those are a part of me, because as a black female, you can see yourself reflected in all these spaces. But then when you actually realise also that you will be discriminated against in a way that maybe isn't as bad at home because of racial hierarchies that exist in these countries that are a lot worse because of the impact of colonialism, because of the legacy of white supremacy, and because of the disparities between rich and poor, it's like, it was a constant sort of head-bending.
It's massively complex.
massively complex to pass as Cuban and Dominican and then, you know, in the same moment be refused entry to a bar or a club because people think you're Cuban or Dominican. So it's like, then I'd have to speak English really loudly and suddenly my privilege would get restored to me. it was just interesting to see constantly how all those different facets of my identity were intersecting, and how one would overshadow the other depending on how I dressed or what passport I had or what language I spoke.
And I feel like what you learnt about more than anyone else could do in a funny kind of way is race itself and how it's constructed and what it means. Like, I don't think I've ever met anyone in a position to understand that through so many different facets and lenses.
Yeah, for sure. And I tried to put that down in the book, you know, my personal experience growing up sort of as a black woman in with a white cultural identity in a white family. That's one perspective. But then as a traveling black woman in these black spaces, I think lots more people are writing about that now. We just see how blackness is constructed around the world. And I wouldn't, you know, go as far as to say, you know, race is fluid, because for a lot of people of color, it's not fluid. It just speaks to, I guess, the flimsiness of our racial constructs and how different they are in each community that exists around the world within the diaspora. You know, being Black in this country is not the same as being Black in America. Being Black in America is not the same as being Black in South Africa, for example. Like, racial categories change all the time, and the boundaries are always moved. So it was interesting, yeah, to see that at play, and also to see how ethnicity, nationality, and race and gender all intersect for someone like me.
And this, and you know, the idea of like anyone being racially pure on any level for any kind of, you know, identity or race is just so collapsible, particularly as soon as you start to look at DNA evidence and how mixed we all are ultimately somewhere in our heritage.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
But you found that you had quite a strong Nigerian heritage when you took your DNA test, I think.
Yeah. So on the road, I partnered with the DNA company contacted me after they read some of my writing online. They said, we'd love to offer you a DNA test. We can film it in your next country. Where are you going to be? And I was in Mexico, I think. And we filmed like a video of me talking about my story. And then they'd given me this free test. So I thought, okay, great. Like, I wonder what it will say. And then when I found out the results, I was in Nicaragua, and it was weird. It was a very weird moment opening it in Nicaragua, having not really spoken to my family about, you know, my plans to take this test, and then it coming back and saying I was basically 50% Nigerian. And I was like, oh, okay. Like, after all this time sort of spent in in a weird kind of racial no man's land almost, or just not having an answer.
It's actually very specific in the end, isn't it? You know?
And very sort of 50-50 split. And I was sort of dreaming of having, you know, this like weird...
everything.
Yeah.
Weird woman of the world.
from bits all over the world. And it was literally 50-50. And I was like, oh, okay, cool. And I've got lots of like British Nigerian friends in London, and they were all just like, way, welcome to the club. And I was like...
But what does it mean to be Nigerian if you've never been Nigerian? You know, that's like a whole other complex.
Exactly. It feels really odd even sort of claiming it. If somebody asks where I'm from now, you know, I've got three or four different answers prepared based on how long we've got, who they are, how much I'm in the bus, because
how much energy you've got right now.
Yeah, because yeah, I can't sit here and talk about my Nigerian cultural heritage because I don't have that, and maybe I never will. But I guess I can speak to those DNA test results because it's such a big split, and on a continental level, they're quite accurate.
Right, so right.
It's likely also that I, you know, I found a Black relative through the site, but she's quite a distant relative, so I couldn't really match with anyone closer. But she was Nigerian, and we met up, and I put that in the book, and that was a really cool moment to just see another Black face that was also a relative of mine. I'd never had that before.
Yeah. Yeah.
But she was Nigerian. So I spoke to an expert and they said, oh, it's likely then that your biological parent is Nigerian. If you've got these two links, it's likely. And I was like, okay, cool. I can accept it, but it still in a way doesn't feel real because I don't know anything about Nigerian culture through sort of, you know, family osmosis, as most people get their cultural identity, you know.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. Those little fragments of stuff that come from food and storytelling and turns of phrase, you know.
Yeah. And people are like, do you miss it or do you wish you had it? And I was like, you can't miss something that you never had. Like, I don't know what I've lost because I had quite a full upbringing. It just wasn't the one that people assume matches my skin color or my appearance. Do you know what I mean? But I'd love to find out more about my Nigerian side. I'd love to find out more about that family that probably doesn't know I exist.
Because you've never tracked down your biological father.
Yeah, no, I mean, I keep my DNA in these sites, but I haven't found a closer relative. I haven't found him. And I don't really know where to go because I don't have a close enough match to even sort of like triangulate all these reference points. So yeah.
So it's like there's an open possibility for the future there, isn't there?
It is. But you know, if it never happened, I wouldn't be devastated because I had such a great father and I had a great cultural upbringing in what I know. I never felt like I missed out on much growing up in terms of like a cultural identity because I didn't know what I was missing. So it's hard to sort of align myself.
It's not like you're cultureless, is it? You've got a culture. It's just not the culture that people expect you to have, maybe.
But I think having spoken to a lot of my, you know, British Nigerian friends, it's sort of a similar issue because they're Black and they're British, but they're second or third generation. So you obviously, you feel that loss maybe more acutely when your parent is actually from one country and you're you're maybe not able to speak the language as well, or you're not able to uphold the traditions in the same way because you were born in Britain. So anyone that's born in Britain but has, you know, parents from another country, I think they kind of can speak to that experience a little bit as well. Mm. Definitely like similarities.
Yeah, yeah.
Except they've always sort of known what they are, and I've always had questions, but it's similar in some ways, I think.
Absolutely. So to close the story, I guess, you and your mum did some work in the end, didn't you? I mean, I think one of the things that comes across you from your book is like the power of really good therapy to make things, to set things straight again.
Yeah. Yeah. Therapy is amazing. Again, I feel really lucky that I had money to see a therapist once a week. I found a black female therapist in South London, and that was really powerful to have conversations about things I'd never been able to find the language for.
Right.
And, you know, having her talk about experiences like mine with other people, she, you know, she's saying there's a lot of similarities between you and some of her clients who are adopted, or there was a lot to talk about with her, and I found that really, really liberating. And then my mum found a therapist for me and her also in South London, who was a white lady called Justine, who's amazing. And she really helped me and my mum hear each other.
Yeah. And it sounds like, you know, there was grunt work to do. It was not straight, you know, it wasn't like a straightforward, you sat down in front of the therapist and everything flowed out. It sounded long and hard, but, you know, you won in the end between you.
Yeah, it was arduous, painful, awkward, yeah. Like frustrating at first, because my mum doesn't talk as much as me, and she'd got used to obviously not talking about this thing at the heart of our family. Mm. And I'd always have to do all the explaining and all the questioning. So I was very angry at first, because I'd said, you've no idea what you've put me through. I've had to keep defending our family, defending you. And people made jokes about, you know, my mum and the postman. I'd heard it all by this point. And
yeah, yeah.
I had to do a lot of sort of forgiving, I guess, and also just a lot of work on myself. And I was quite angry at my mum for that at the beginning. And then by the end, you know, we stuck at it for 2 years, maybe two and a half.
Wow.
Every week. And by the end, it was like so much of that anger just evaporated. And my mum was so much more open and so much more able to hear me and understand.
I so admire you both for sticking with that. That must have been so hard to stick with that for 2.5 years. That's an incredible piece of work to do.
Yeah.
It really is.
Yeah, no, yeah, like, yeah, it is. It was hard. It was really hard. There was times when I'd walk out, or she'd walk out, or somebody would feel, you know, affronted at something someone else had said, and they'd be screaming. It was really hard, painful work. And even in the book, I couldn't replicate all those moments, because it's so painful to even go back on, because it's like, you know, it's like my mum, I didn't want to cut my mum out. I'd already lost my dad. I wasn't about to ostracize myself from my family, but it was a long old road, as my mum says.
Yeah. Yeah. And your therapist must have had a great time.
I think we were her best client. I think she was fascinated by it, but she was also, I found out she was so good at helping me and my mum hear each other. And I found out at the end that she actually had mixed race children herself. And I think that really brought to the experience I was quite suspicious at first. I thought, oh, she's a white woman, she's not going to get all of this. I'm going to have her and my mum gang up on me. But it was really, she just struck the correct balance with both of us at all times. And then I found out, okay, she has a bit of personal experience that she brought to it as well, but I didn't feel that. It was just sort of a suspicion. I was correct.
It's amazing. And so how are things now? I mean, like, I, you know, your mum sounds wonderful, just someone that got stuck for a while.
Yeah, she got stuck for a long time, I think, in her own head.
Yeah, maybe a while's a bit of an understatement.
Yeah, years, like 2 decades. But she was allowed, you know, it was her and my dad, they, I guess, silently conspired to raise me and my brother, you know, the same way. Like, they both adopted this silence, and my dad just never challenged her, and my mum, she wasn't forthcoming once she knew that she didn't have to speak about it. So
yeah.
She's a lot more open now, which is great, and a lot more able to kind of talk about race and identity without it necessarily looping back to me and, you know, us reliving something really painful. It doesn't erupt into arguments. And if I want to say something to my mum and I feel like I've, you know, gone through something or I've got a story, she'll just listen and she'll be able to offer some support, which before quite hard to do that, because I think she's worried about the story coming out. So we'd never really discuss anything to do with race.
Yeah.
As the therapist said, that kept us separate from one another. So it's good that we've now, I think, become a bit closer.
Got a common language. And actually, I mean, your mum's gone on a journey that loads of white people have gone on over the last couple of years. You know, like, we as a society are hopefully learning to speak about this better and to have some language that's no longer offensive, but which is also like a bit more frank and a bit less illusory and kind of embarrassed about the whole thing.
Yeah, for sure. And I hope, you know, Raceless, my book, will help inspire some of those difficult conversations, because as we're mixing more as a society, and as, you know, we're having relationships, closer relationships with people that are of a different cultural or ethnic background to us, we need to like have honest, nuanced discussions about privilege and difference and love and discrimination, and we need to have them without it erupting or without, you know, there being, you know, parts of the conversation that are overlooked or silenced.
And pretending we don't see colour does not help.
No, yeah, I guess I get quite a few messages from people like, oh, I need to talk to my child and my, you know, partner about race. How should I do it? And I'm like, God, I don't have kids and I don't know what to advise. But if you buy the book, then maybe that will give you some inspo, because it's so hard to speak to other people's experiences. I can only, you know, discuss what I've done and what worked for me.
But oh my God, kids can handle so much more than we expect them to. Like, you just talk directly to kids about stuff and they absorb it. Like, they don't carry the baggage that we carry of, you know, like loads of people in my, I mean, I'm 43, getting old. But, you know, like, we were raised to say that we don't see colour. Like, that was the that was the polite thing to say when I was a kid. And that was like the, you know, that would have been perceived as right on. And that it takes us a while to U-turn from, you know, realizing that we thought we were being really good all the time. And, oh, no, sorry, actually, it's quite offensive. I mean, kids just don't carry that baggage. We can start all over again with them. And that's great.
Yeah, I definitely, you know, having spoken to my mum and getting that insight into her mind and what it was like for her growing up in the 60s and 70s, I can see how it was just a completely different approach to race and how many people of that generation are, you know, they're playing catch up in a way, I guess, to to what's going on now, which is a real sort of open dialogue around all aspects of identity and underrepresented voices. Like, we're so much more attuned to that lack of a voice now, so it's great to be in that position and great to be a writer in these times, I think.
Oh, and we're glad to have you. I mean, I think that your book will help so many people to understand a little bit better, to really unpick the issues, and I think it's also just an amazing testament to the power of having really difficult conversations and how it's worth it in the end. So I can't wait for everyone to read it.
Oh, thank you so much. I appreciate that.
Georgina, thank you so much. It's been amazing to talk to you.
And that's all from us today. Thank you so much to Georgina Lawton for sharing her story with us. Raceless is available in all good bookstores, and you can follow Georgina on Instagram or Twitter. Links are in the show notes. I'll be back next week with another brilliant writer who is intimate with winter. Thanks for listening.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And is all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices.
Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.